Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you go to the events page and sign up for the Northwest Arkansas Regional event. That's April 22nd and 23rd. Chad's going to be there. I'm going to be there. A whole host of other people are going to be there. And it's going to be a good time. The reason we know it's going to be a good time is this ain't the first time we've done this, Chad. We have done this before, and it was a great time, and this will be no different. And so we would love to have you come out to the event. It's 2 days, a bunch of talks, a bunch of music, a bunch of food, a bunch of hanging out, and we'd love to do all that with you. So go over there and register. There's also a link in the show notes. It's only $99 if you want to attend for the weekend. Chad, we are still in 1 Kings chapter 9. I think we're going to finally get to the Queen of Sheba today. We've been hinting at it for weeks now, and I think we're finally going to do it. We got to wrap up chapter 9 first, but I think we're going to get there.
Yeah, we first of all have to cover another lady, not the Queen of Sheba, but Pharaoh's daughter. We've already talked about her. Can't remember which episode that was, but a while back. That was, of course, the most famous, at least initially the most famous of the wives that Solomon. We're going to hear more about these wives in a later chapter, but all those wives that Solomon was accumulating. So we are at, 1 Kings 9:24, I believe is where we left off. Been kind of describing a lot of the intricate details of Solomon's reign. We wrapped up last time by talking about all the workers that he had and slaves that he had for his building projects. And so 24 through the end of the chapter, 24 through 28, is going to describe Pharaoh's daughter and then the sacrificial life, I guess you'd say, of Solomon. And then we're going to hear about Solomon the sailor, which is kind of a strange thing for an Israelite. So 24 tells us Pharaoh's daughter went out from the city of David to her own house that Solomon had built for her. So city of David is a little bit lower down south of where the palace was and where the temple was built. So she moves up. City of David, by the way, we're kind of accustomed, I think, to hearing that with New Testament ears. So this is not Bethlehem. This is a part of Jerusalem called the city of David. So she goes up from the city of David to her own house that Solomon had built for her. So they didn't live together. He had a separate house for her. And I like your explanation, Dan, for why you think he did that.
The explanation is initially he is keeping up appearances. So he's like, don't worry about it, people of Israel. I'm not going to have this woman living in my house. This is a purely political arrangement. And so we have to have her over there. This is going to keep all of you safe. I was happy to sacrifice in this way and do this marriage alliance. Of course, Solomon is going to be quite a fan of the ladies. And so those appearances are going to cease to be kept up because he's not going to be just a fan of Jewish ladies, but he's also going to be a fan of all kinds of ladies from all kinds of places. And eventually, he's not going to be able to just sort of push them off to the side and have nobody notice or forget about them.
Yeah, by the time we get to chapter 11, which is definitely the chapter of the downfall of Solomon. Yeah, we're going to hear about 700 wives, 300 concubines. So you're not going to have 1,000 houses in Jerusalem for all your various lovers and wives.
He might have to build a dormitory, but you can't give everyone their own house.
No. Not enough real estate in the city of Jerusalem for that. But when he starts out anyway, that's what he does. He builds this special house for the daughter of Pharaoh. Then we're told in verse 25 that three times a year Solomon would offer up burnt offerings and peace offerings on the altar that he had built to the Lord. This three times a year, presumably, are the three major feasts, Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles in the fall. We're not told that explicitly, but that would stand to reason. So Solomon is busy building. He's busy building homes for himself, busy building homes for his wife and then his wives. And then he is also busy at the Lord's house, offering the burnt offerings and the peace offerings. And then we're told that he also built something else. This is verses 26 through 28. King Solomon built a fleet of ships at Ezion-Geber, which is, so if you kind of in your imagination go south from the Dead Sea, work your way through the land of Edom all the way to the Gulf of Aqaba, So this is the eastern coast of the Sinai Peninsula. That's where you find Ezion Geber. And this was, of course, a perfect place to have a harbor with a fleet of ships, which could sail southward from there. And we're told that he kind of worked with Hiram. So Hiram, his friend from up in Tyre, he sent with the fleet his servants, these sailors who were familiar with the sea, and they worked basically with the servants of Solomon. Because if you know anything about the Israelites, you know they were lovers of the land. They were not lovers of the sea, because for the Israelite, the sea was the place of chaos. The sea was the place where you had sea monsters. The sea was the place where basically everything negative was located. So you have the tripart, the three-story house in the Israelite imagination, the heavens, the dry land, and then the sea. And so the sea is everything that you don't want. Okay, this chaos, this confusion, also sometimes equated with Sheol. So the Israelites just stayed in the land. But Solomon ventures out into the sea, but he doesn't do so by himself. He enlists the Tyrrhenians who knew the sea. They knew how to build ships. They knew how to handle them. And so they work with Solomon for this. And they went from there, we're told, to a place called Ophir. I wish we knew more about this place. There's all kinds of guesses, hypotheses as to exactly where this was located. It's mentioned, Ophir is mentioned a lot of times in the Old Testament. Here, other places in 1 Kings, in Chronicles, in Job, in the book of Psalms, in Isaiah, all these mention this place that we just really can't locate on the map. There's all kinds of possibilities, everything from southeastern Africa to India, to the Far East. Probably we're talking about part of the Arabian Peninsula is what most scholars lean toward. But wherever exactly it was, it had a lot of gold there, because gold is often associated with Ophir. So they went to Ophir with these ships, and they brought from there gold, a whole bunch of it, and took it to King Solomon. And that's the way the chapter wraps up. So we're getting a pretty well-developed picture of Solomon. We talked a lot about his wisdom, his building projects, the way that he organized his kingdom, the connection that he had with a lot of foreign kings and foreign nations who were paying tribute to him. And here we hear that he even ventured out to do something that no Israelite before him had ever done, and that is to start not really a navy, but at least a fleet of ships. We'll hear more about those in the next chapter. So we are definitely, and this is going to build in the next chapter, we're definitely getting the picture of Solomon as an international figure, I guess is what we would call him today. I mean, he has all kinds of connections to the nations, north, south, east, west, and people are paying tribute to him. And as we'll see in the chapter that we're transitioning to now, he even has dignitaries from these other countries coming to his court in order to listen to him. And as we'll see with the Queen of Sheba, they are breathlessly astonished at the wisdom and the wealth that Solomon has.
It does seem that Solomon is benefiting from getting to reign in a time of, or at least, initially, of relative peace. You know, he's getting to do a lot of things because he's not having to fight a bunch of battles and stuff, right? You're not hearing about him building these things and then having to halt construction to go fend off these people over here. And since the Philistines aren't beating down his door, he's putting together fleets of ships and all this stuff. You read this and you're like, man, this just reads way different than the beginning of David's reign or Saul. You know, these guys were in conflict all the time. And it seems that initially Solomon gets to, some of it's his own doing. He makes some alliances and he has positioned himself as somebody that you don't want to mess with, because it's not just that because he's powerful, but he's also got powerful allies now. But it really has afforded him the opportunity to do other things when the defense of the nation is not, preeminent among all things right now.
Yeah, that's something that's pretty easy to overlook. And it applies not just to Solomon, but you can look throughout world history and see how this is the case. I mean, anytime you look at our own country, what happened during World War II, when you got a major war going on, that is where all of your intellectual and economic resources go.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, if you don't, then you might lose. And if you lose, then of course, everything is over. So this, as you say, this afforded Solomon, the peace afforded Solomon the opportunity to do things, both building projects as well as trade, as well as intellectual pursuits that you just can't do if if you're fighting wars on various fronts.
Yeah, you can't build ships and bridges when you need all those materials for swords and arrows. That's just not how it works. One of those things takes priority in time of war.
I mean,
you see this in modern day. Like you start, we haven't had this happen in a long time. Maybe a little bit like with COVID, but you know, during World War II, it's like we ain't making cars, we're making airplanes. You know, we're not making this other washer machines, we're making bombs. You know, and everything has to be put on hold for the war effort. And it was no different back then. I mean, probably even more so back then. I mean, if you're at war, it's all hands on deck, and you can't be worried about maybe we can improve the road system and make a clear path from here to this other place that we want to trade with and stuff. You can't be doing that at that time.
Yeah. This is part of my own family history. So if you go back several generations to the time of the Revolutionary War, one of my ancestors, Mark Byrd, had a iron plantation in Pennsylvania. And before the war, they made potbelly stoves and things like that. And then during the war, everything had to change and they started making cannons.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's one example that you could just then multiply to all kinds of industries. You're making this before the war. Oh, well, not now. Now you're making this because it has to support the war effort. So, yeah, I mean, it's an easy fact to overlook in the life of Solomon that one of the reasons he was able to do this is because of the relative peace that he enjoyed. Otherwise, a lot of the things he accomplished would not be feasible. Well, the fame of Solomon began to spread far and wide, and one of the places to which it spread was a place called Sheba. And this is another, like Ophir, I wish we knew where Sheba was. There's a lot of different ideas. Most people say that it is either Ethiopia or it is a little bit across from there in Yemen. So anyway, southwest of Israel. This would kind of make sense given what we're already talking about with Ezion Geber and the Gulf of Aqaba and that particular region, that the Queen of Sheba would be coming up from there. So wherever exactly she's from, the reputation of Solomon reaches her. And so she decides she is going to gather a bunch of camels, gather a bunch of goods, and she's going to go see for herself whether these reports that she has heard about Solomon are true. So we're told now, this is 10, verse 1. Now when the Queen of Sheba heard of the famous Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to, the ESV has, she came to test him with hard questions. The hard questions there in Hebrew is chidah, which is riddles. So if you think back to Samson's life and the riddle that he proposed to the Philistines, same word there. So she had these riddles, some kind of, you know, hard things to solve, and she wanted to come and I guess test the wisdom of Solomon to see if he could solve these riddles.
Yeah, this
I wish they'd have told us what some of these riddles were.
I know. I was going to say, of all, come on now. Like, we get a lot of details about some things. Like, how about some riddles? Let's get some riddles in here. We don't get those, but it does tell you the kind of reputation that Solomon has, right? Where this guy is unstumpable. And so this queen says, I'm going to go and I'm going to write down the best riddles that I have and see what his answers are. And so he doesn't have like this reputation of maybe like what you would think a lot of kings have, like, oh, he's powerful or he is not to be trifled with or whatever. He has a different kind of reputation for a king, which is this man is exceedingly wise.
Yeah, you can see her probably before she leaves. She's gathering all her wise men. She's saying, all right, I want your best riddles.
Yeah.
And you should write these down because I'm going to go test this king in Jerusalem that I just keep hearing all this stuff about and find out whether his wisdom is indeed true.
You know, wisdom can be a military deterrent too, I suppose. I mean, of course, Solomon has like might and strength, and like we said, he has allies and all that. But, you know, if someone proposed going to war with somebody and the person that they proposed you go to war with has a reputation of being the wisest man around, that's a little intimidating. You're like, I don't know, this guy is supposed to be pretty smart. Like, I don't know how much I want to go fight this guy. He might beat us strictly simply based on the fact that his intellect is far superior to ours.
Yeah, maybe as a come up with a better strategy because of his superior intelligence. It's always possible. Yeah. By the way, this is a great counterpoint to really the first story that we were exposed to in which Solomon demonstrated his wisdom. Except that was very local. You had the two women who were prostitutes living together, and you had the whole debate back and forth between them as to whose son was alive and whose son was dead. And that was right after Solomon was had the dream, and he asked God for a listening heart, and God gave that to him. So he gave him this wisdom. And this was exemplified in the story of these two presumably local women who had this dispute. Now you come to a different situation, and you have one woman, and she is, of course, not a prostitute. She's a queen, and she's not from around Jerusalem. She's from the far off place called Sheba. So this is this works as a nice structuring mechanism for the life of Solomon. He begins by demonstrating his wisdom with these two local prostitutes who are disputing about a child. And now he's going to once more demonstrate his wisdom toward a lady, except now it's going to be a royal person from Sheba.
It is interesting too that Solomon does seem to be demonstrating his wisdom with women a lot. And we know from, you know, when it describes Solomon, we know that all the sons of David seem like they're described as good-looking guys, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know what kind of reputation Solomon has, but this Queen of Sheba seems like real interested to go. And you have to think that this is this extremely wise, fairly charismatic. He's into the arts and building things and all this stuff. And presumably, as the text tells us, is a good-looking guy. And so, you know, Queen wants to go check this out. You got this smart, creative, good-looking king over there in Israel. So time to take a road trip.
Yeah. I mean, what's not to like? I mean, guys can look up to him, and every guy probably thinks, man, I wish I was as good-looking and as smart and as accomplished as Solomon.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, you know that he's attracting the attention of the ladies as well. So she's gonna go find out for herself. So she comes to Jerusalem with a large group. She's got this retinue with her, and they've got camels who are bearing spices, and they've got gold, they got precious stones. So she doesn't just show up. She just, you know, just pull up with a couple camels and say, hey, I heard about you. Just wanted to throw a few riddles your way. This is a big deal. And a big group that are coming. All these gifts, the spices for which this part of the world was known, and all the gold and precious stones. Like, Solomon did not need more gold or precious stones, but of course, she's bringing these as an offering, as a gift to him.
Yeah, this is just a big flex. I mean, this is why this partly seems like curiosity. It also seems like a bunch of flirtation going on. Like, I'll bring all my stuff, show you what I got going on with, you know, I'm just going to bring you this stuff because I don't want you to think that I don't have, I'm not a woman of resources. Of course, course I am. And now I just want to sit and chat with you a little bit, Solomon. It's a whole thing, man.
Yeah. There's always political flexing going on today as well as in the ancient times. So she shows up, she comes to Solomon, and we're told that she told him all that was on her mind. Again, we're just teased. You know, we're not told one of the riddles that she propounded. We're not told really what she said to him, at least initially what she said to him. But she did propound these riddles to him, ask him questions. And we're told in verse 3 that Solomon scored an A+. He answered all her questions. There was nothing hidden from the king that he could not explain to her. So, yeah, more Solomonic wisdom at work here. No surprise. It wasn't. And we don't expect to read. And Solomon was able to solve all of her riddles save one. No, of course, Solomon was able to tell her everything that she wanted to know.
The way it reads is there was nothing he could not explain to her. He just had every answer. I mean, what a guy.
The question, he's got
what
the
a guy.
Whatever the riddle, he's got the solution.
Every question you could think of, I got the answer for it. I mean, that's an impressive feat.
It is. It reminds me, I just was reading this morning about when I can't remember which chapter this is in Matthew 21, 22, where you know, the Pharisees come to Jesus, they try and trap him with a question. The Sadducees come to Jesus, they tell him the story about the woman who went through seven husbands, you know, whose wife is she gonna be in the resurrection? Well, Jesus, you know, he stumps them, and so the Pharisees hear about this and they're like, well, let's go back. They got him a question. And Jesus answers that. And then he says, yeah, since I've got you all here, what's your opinion? Whose son is the Messiah? And then they say, well, you know, the son of David. And then Jesus goes back, well, if he's David's son, then why does David call him Lord? And the chapter ends by saying, and from that point on, nobody dared to ask him any more questions.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a Solomonic moment too, like, whatever question you put to Jesus, he's always got the answer. And then he's liable to come back with a question of his own and trap you.
Yeah.
So best just not to engage him in dialogue. That's kind of what's going on here. I mean, of course, Solomon is a messianic figure. He's a prefigurement of our Lord. And so it fits with his ability, his wisdom, his, you know, he can answer all the questions, whatever they might be.
Yeah, yeah. Solomon, just that lesser Jesus. I've always thought it was a bad idea to try to get into a war of words with the Word made flesh. I think this is a bad move.
Yeah, it's always don't want to set yourself up for failure.
Like I invented speech. Like don't want to try to beat that guy in an argument.
No, not the guy you want to be in a debate with. So when verse 4, when the Queen of Sheba had seen all the wisdom of Solomon. Now, how do you see wisdom? Well, you see how wisdom has been manifested. You hear, of course, the wisdom as well. So when she's seen all this, and we have a list of all the things that she saw: the house that he'd built, the food on his table, the seating of his officials, the attendance of his servants, their clothing, and we're getting down to like minutia here, his cupbearers, and his burnt offering that he offered at the house of the Lord. So she sees all this. Everything from the way his servants are dressed. I mean, like I guess they had uniforms, I suppose, or just, you know, the beauty of their clothing. And I guess she's taken to the temple and she sees all these burnt offerings.
The seating of his officials, just like how they sit around Solomon, and, you know, how he takes care of them, you know, how they present themselves. It's pretty impressive, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, in other words, she sees that Solomon, talk about having his act together.
Yeah.
I mean, in every sort of way, just himself personally, his whole public officials, down to the very clothing that his servants wear. So she sees all this, and here's a response. Literally, she was breathless.
Yes, there was.
Which is translated by the ESV is there was no more breath in her.
Yes.
Which, I think it would have been a lot more poetic had the translators opted for she was breathless. Because, yeah. I mean, that really is what is being described here. That's pretty literal from the Hebrew there. It's like it took her breath away.
In other words, she left and went back to Sheba with a big, huge crush on Solomon.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds. I mean, how do you read there was no more breath? Like, I get it that she's like in awe of it all, but like she's in awe of him, right?
Yes. Yeah, which is why. I mean, there's a everyone's probably familiar with those traditions. I think it's from the Ethiopian source, which says that they became lovers
while
the Queen of Sheba was there, and then she became pregnant and went home, and then had a son who was, of course, the son of Solomon, who began a dynasty there in Ethiopia. I mean, that's all just based upon, you know, just guesswork. It's just a legend. I mean, is it possible? Certainly it's possible.
Doesn't sound like something Solomon would do.
No. I mean, Solomon was pretty conservative when it came to women. You know, one, we don't know, of course, but that is part of the legend surrounding, one of the legends surrounding the Queen of Sheba. But she's obviously, one thing we do know is she was breathless. She was, her breath was taken away. By the way, this image is kind of a neat parallel, because that is the same sort of language that another woman uses in reference to Israel, except in this case, it's Rahab back in Joshua 2. When she's, you know, when the spies come and she hides them and she's talking with them about everything that she's heard that God has done for Israel, she says that This is Joshua 2:11. As soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no spirit, or there was no breath left in anyone because of you. So it is this idea of, yeah, that took our breath away in a different sort of way, of course, in the Queen of Sheba. But still, the idea is that you're presented with these great grand things that either are the work of God or the work of God through his people, and you're breathless. Your spirit is taken away from you, whether you're Rahab or the Queen of Sheba. So what does she say to the king? Well, she lays it on pretty thick, actually. She says, the report was true that I heard in my own land of your words and of your wisdom. So, you know, all this, I kept hearing these reports about this great King Solomon and how smart he was and, you know, all the things that he would say. And, well, that's true. But she says in verse 7, I just didn't believe it. I didn't believe the reports until I came and my own eyes had seen it. So a very Thomas the Apostle sort of moment for her. it's not enough to hear. I need to see it with my own eyes. You know, I need to put my fingers in the wounds, as Thomas would say. So she didn't believe it. She heard all about it, but now she does. Heard the reports, and I have now seen it with my own eyes. And then she adds, in fact, tell you what, the half was not told me. Your wisdom and prosperity surpass the report that I heard. So I heard great things, but man, I didn't hear the half of what was true.
Yeah, this is a rare thing. If you hear about something that's incredible, and you know, it's like if a movie comes out and like all your friends are just talking it up.
Yes, raving. Yeah.
Just raving. It almost becomes impossible for this movie to live up to all the hype, right? And normally,
like I usually set myself up to be disappointed. I'm like, no, wait, it can't be that good.
Right, yeah. Like, typically, it's a good idea not to believe the hype. Don't believe the hype when it comes to most things because, you know, people get carried away and then things get exaggerated. And, you know, especially this time, it's not like you can just show someone a video. Like, no, here, check it out. Like, it's amazing. Like, this is all rumor. This is all passed from one person to another person to another person. And so she's like, you know, at some point, this game of telephone here has got to have been quite exaggerated. Not in this case. In this case, this lived up to all the hype and more. She says, this is twice as good as the best report I heard.
Yeah. Talk about a rarity.
Yeah, this never happens. Yeah,
never happens. But it did. It did in this case. So she goes on to kind of a twofold blessing. In verse 8, she says, ESV translated as happy are your men. The word used there in Hebrew is asherei. That's the opening word of the Psalter. So Psalm 1:1 begins with, blessed is the man. Blessed is man who doesn't walk in the counsel of the wicked, so on and so forth. That's asherei. So happy is one possible translation. I really prefer blessed. I think the reason ESV chose to translate this as happy is because in the next verse, she says, blessed be the Lord your God. Now that's Baruch. It's a different Hebrew word. Sometimes they're both translated as blessed, but I think that's probably why the translators made a distinction here between happy and blessed, between Asherei and Baruch. But either way, both can be translated as blessed.
Yeah, well, so, there's something interesting about that too. I've always kind of liked the correlation between blessed and happy. This happens when Jesus is giving the Sermon on the Mount and stuff too, where you have blessed are the pure in heart, blessed are the poor in spirit. And you're like, what is all this about? And you can, in that place as well, sort of translate that as, oh, the happiness or oh, the joy of the poor in spirit. What it means is that to be blessed, this is different than just being blessed in the sense that you're like, man, I was really blessed to be able to get a good deal on this house or whatever. You know, really blessed. Blessed is a different thing. Since we struggle so much to figure out like what joy really is and what happiness really is and how these work within the life of a believer and stuff, what it means is that God has looked upon you with favor, and that is the source of joy. And that is connected with blessedness, right? And so when we talk about the new heavens and the new earth and living in everlasting blessedness, we are talking about a happiness, a joy that is not based in simply, it's not just because you have all these things, but it's because you have the favor of God. And so I kind of like that those words are connected, because I think it helps helps us understand like what is joy and how, why is that such a big thing in the scriptures and why are we told to have that? And what it really just means is to find happiness in the favor of the Lord.
Yeah, it's a great way of reconfiguring what true happiness is.
Mm-hmm.
Because we, you know, when we think about happiness today, we, you know, there are exceptions, but typically we think of it's kind of in a very shallow, ephemeral sort of just emotional sense. And so if you hear the Beatitudes or hear even the Psalms, redefining happiness is that what true joy, what true human thriving and happiness is. Well, that's great because this is God's way of saying you want to really be truly joyful. I mean, you want to have that kind of human happiness that I've created you to receive. Well, here you go. This is how it's achieved. And of course, in the Beatitudes, it's kind of ironic because it's not what you would think. You would think, you know, happy are the rich in spirit or whatever it might be, or happy are those who are not mourning. But the Beatitudes have that way of turning things around to give you that upside down perspective that God brings to us.
Yeah, it's a different sort of happiness. It's a joy is a happiness that is a deep, durable dependency on God. Mm-hmm. And the poor in spirit can have that.
Yeah.
And the pure in heart can have that. And that's what that is. And that's way better than some, I'm temporarily happy because I have this thing that can be taken away from me.
Yeah. And I think when you put blessed and happy together, that's a great way of kind of indicating the, what we may say, like the source and the result, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you happy? Because you're blessed. So that blessing leads to happiness. And so you kind of get both the divine and the human element there together.
And why are you blessed? Because of God.
Yes. Yes. Precisely. Yeah. So it goes, God gives a blessing, which results in this true God-given happiness in those to whom the gift is given.
Yeah, I mean, what she's essentially saying here is, man, God is really smiling down on you, and your men are happy, and your servants are happy, and everyone's happy because mm-hmm. everyone's blessed because God has looked upon you with favor.
Yeah, I mean, she really does. She describes an ideal kind of place. I mean, there's no hint here whatsoever of anything negative.
Right.
Solomon is obviously blessed, but she says here, happy are your men. Happy are your servants who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. So there's this ripple effect. That seemed to be the idea here, that she's come to really, she didn't come to see the servants of Solomon. She came to see Solomon himself. But what she realizes while she's there is that this gift that God has given to Solomon has rippled outward so that his entire kingdom benefits. Now, of course, we're going to get to the dark side of this eventually. But we can't discount the fact that the scriptures also do highlight quite extensively the good that came from Solomon. So yeah, there's going to be plenty of bad stuff, which we'll get to in the next chapter. But we can't let that bad stuff, as it were, detract from all the good stuff.
Right. No, I mean at the
both happens are at once.
Yeah, I mean at the front end of Solomon's reign, it's going great.
Mm-hmm.
And this is of course before. You know, you got what is going to be the undoing of this? Well, it's the same thing that always is, and like, we're gonna see fidelity to God in worship is going to be the ruin of all of this stuff, that all this happiness. Like so, mm-hmm. true happiness is also found then in the worship of God and God alone, which of course is going to then this happiness is going to cease when that ceases.
Yeah. Yeah. Monotheistic joy. Right?
That's right. This is correct.
Polytheistic sorrow. That's the way this works. So happy your men, happy your servants to continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. And then she says, and this is the Baruch, so blessed. Blessed be the Lord your God. Now, it's incredible. Just pause to think about this. This is a Gentile queen. She's come from the ends of the earth. At least, you know, that's the way they would have thought about this. That, you know, oh my gosh, Sheba? Yeah, that's like the ends of the earth. She's come from the ends of the earth, Gentile woman. And whose name is on her lips? Yahweh. So blessed be Yahweh. It doesn't say just blessed be your God, but blessed be Yahweh, your God, who has delighted in you and set you on the throne of Israel. And listen to this. Because Yahweh, she says it again, because Yahweh loved Israel forever, he has made you king, that you may execute justice and righteousness. That's a heck of a speech.
Yeah, so she says, man, God has really delighted in you. God really likes you because he loves Israel.
Yeah. She's quite the theologian here. I mean, she points it back to why you have such impressive wisdom and such impressive kingdom. Well, because the Lord loved Israel. She pinpoints the cause of all of this in the heart of God. That's what she traces it all back to. So, an excellent theologian from Sheba, because she points to the source of all these good things in God and God alone, loving Israel.
And then she's like, you know what, you need 75 pounds more gold.
Yeah, what you really need is some more gold. So she gives him. She had the camels were loaded down with all the spices and gold and precious stones and whatnot. So she gave to the king 120 talents of gold, tons of gold. He had enough, but she gave him more. And a very great quantity of spices and precious stones, and we're told never again. I mean, these spices were very impressive, because never again came such an abundance of spices such as these that the Queen of Sheba gave to Solomon. Now, we can't talk about the Queen of Sheba without venturing into the Gospels for a minute, too, because twice, I believe it's in Matthew and in Luke's Gospel, where you have her come up. She becomes the example of this is Matthew, I don't have the Luke reference, but Matthew 12. She becomes the example of one who was outside Israel and came to Israel in order to hear Solomon and to, as we just saw, and to confess that the Lord, because of his love for Israel, had given all these good gifts to the king and to the rest of the kingdom. And Jesus, in Matthew 12, 41 and 42, first of all, he references actually two Gentile kingdoms. He says, the men of Nineveh will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, for they repented at the preaching of Jonah. And behold, something greater than Jonah is here. So we have that superiority to the prophet here. So Jesus is saying,
by the way, that's the understatement of the entire Bible.
There's something greater than Jonah is here. Yeah. You don't have to work too hard to be better than
you want to compare the Jonah. If you want to compare the preaching of Jesus to the preaching of Jonah, yeah, I would say that Jesus is greater.
Yeah. If anybody ever says, you know, my preacher is about the he's as good a preacher as Jonah is.
Good
well,
for
that's
you.
That's not saying much. So, and then he goes on, Jesus goes on, the queen of the south, so talking about the Queen of Sheba, the queen of the south will rise up at this judgment, at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, for she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And behold, something greater than Solomon is here.
Now that is quite the statement.
That is saying something there.
Because he's saying a better preacher than Jonah is here. Okay. Someone wiser than Solomon is here. Oh, okay.
Well, yeah, that's impressive there. Yeah. So, I mean, both those examples, the Ninevites as well as the Queen of Sheba, they're the kind of examples we see in several places throughout the scriptures where you do have this unexpected reversal happening. And of course, Jesus says the same thing in his sermon in his hometown of Nazareth, when he talks about how, you know, a lot of widows in Israel, but that's not who God sent the prophet to. And there were a lot of lepers, but it was Naaman the Syrian who was healed. So God does have his way, Old and New Testament, of using these people who are outsiders, outside the land of Israel, Gentiles, to demonstrate that, hey, they want the true wisdom of God. They want the true grace of God. They want the true healing of God. So look to them as examples and steer clear of the tendency that very often happens with the chosen, if you will, with the people of God, to grow bored with the gifts of God, or even to rebel against those. So Jesus uses this story we've just talked about as an illustration of how the word of God goes forth, and it actually calls people from outside the land of Israel to come to Israel to hear the wisdom and to see the grace of God active in the life of God's people.
That's right. Well, all right, man, we are out of time. There's just a tad more to say about the Queen of Sheba, but that's the bulk of it. Solomon's going to give her some gifts, and she's going to head back home. But we'll touch on that next week, and then get into Solomon's great wealth. We're just going to find out exactly how much wealth does this guy have, and it turns out it's a lot. So We will tackle that next week. I'll see you then, Chad.
See you then.